What is asset protection? Do you need it? How do you get it? What does an effective asset protection plan look like? We have the answers to these questions and many more on this episode of the Talk to Me Doc podcast. As a physician, you routinely check your patient's health, but when was the last time you checked the financial health of your practice? You could needlessly be losing money right now. Stop bleeding money. Get actionable insights about your group's financial performance with a free, no-strings-attached assessment from CareCloud, a leader in medical billing solutions, EHR, and more. CareCloud has over 20 years' experience helping large and small providers boost profitability and has helped thousands of practices optimize their financial operations. Request your free revenue cycle assessment and learn more about your group's performance by visiting drpodcastnetwork.com/CareCloud. That's drpodcastnetwork.com/CareCloud.
Welcome to the Talk to Me Doc podcast, where it's all about serving the early career physician. Let's talk about the unique issues that face us so we can create a better future for ourselves and those to come. And now your host, Dr. Andrew Tisser.
Hey everybody, it's Andrew. Welcome to the Talk to Me Doc podcast. For my returning listeners, thank you so much. And for my new listeners, welcome. Because today, like on every episode, we're talking to the best guests from all around healthcare and beyond on issues relating to the early career physician. Today, we have the treat of talking with Brian Bradley, Esquire. Brian Bradley is the senior managing partner at Bradley Legal Corp and is a leading educator and nationally recognized asset protection attorney for high-risk professionals. Like us. That also includes entrepreneurs, real estate investors, and ultra high net worth families. Collectively, they are protecting over $5 billion worth of assets. Brian's goal is to give you peace of mind knowing your assets are safe. Brian was selected to the Best Attorneys of America list in 2020, Lawyers of Distinction list 3 years in a row, 2018 through 2020, Super Lawyers Rising Star list 2021, and 2015 nominated to America's Top 100 High Stakes Litigators list and the Top 100 in Real Estate. Brian also writes and teaches on advanced estate and strategic planning and is a featured speaker at numerous investment summits, real estate, cash flow, finance, and life coaching shows. Well, I'm excited. Let's get Brian onto the show. Brian Bradley, welcome to the Talk to Me Doc podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Andrew, for having me on and putting this together. This really is a big topic, especially for physicians, and especially if you're also investing in other assets like real estate, you know, or owning your own practice. And so I hope that the concepts we talk about today help your listeners understand this area better and why it's important for them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in learning for myself as well. So let's get right into it. If you could tell the listeners kind of who you are and what you do, and then we'll get right into asset protection.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you said, I'm an asset protection attorney, and, you know, I was selected to America's Best Attorney 2020, Super Lawyers Rising Star 2021 and 2015. I was a top 100 high stake litigator and also, you know, top 100 people in real estate. So I just really love what I do. I'm passionate about the law, investing. And as you start investing and growing more, you grow more, your visibility grows more, and then you start worrying about having to protect it and losing it. And so what we do is help protect assets and wealth with this fancy word called asset protection, which I'll explain what that even means later on. And I got into asset protection from the litigation and trial side of the law and having clients just being sued and their lives just turned completely upside down with the false sense of security. And a lot of these clients, you know, were coming to me after they were already being sued. So after the fact. And at that point, you're just too far down the rabbit hole. There's nothing we can really do for you at that point. So it's really important to have all of this thought about and set up before you ever need it. And I see that what was contributing to this false sense of security comes from people thinking that they just don't need to do anything and they're just going to ride Lady Luck, you know, just like in Vegas. But that's not a plan. That's just wishful thinking, you know, or they think that their insurance will always cover them, which it won't. It's important to have and you need it and you need good insurance. But we're all getting more and more clients with claims that are just radically in excess of their insurance coverage. So being underinsured is a big problem. And it goes hand in hand with malpractice issues, you know, or if you forget to level up your insurance as your wealth levels up or having an umbrella policy. But people think an umbrella policy means that it just covers everything else and it doesn't. It really just provides excess coverage. Another big one is they think that their estate plan known as a revocable living trust will protect you, which it can't. They're not designed to. And they only come into effect when you die and your spouse died to avoid probate. and death taxes. They don't provide any protection for you when you're actually living and being sued. And a big one I think that we're going to really bust today later on is that thinking you can just create an LLC and that's a silver magic bullet and it's going to protect you, and they forget about first letter, first word, limited. And then we start looking at the liability for those in the medical field, you know, which is a lot of your listeners. It goes beyond just the medical profession. You know, there's always a business side that goes beyond malpractice. There's billing issues, payroll violations, sexual harassment claims, and others that are internal and aren't going to be covered by your malpractice, your medical malpractice. And then on the other external issues, like if you own property that you're practicing out of, you own the building that you're practicing out of, or if you're also investing in other assets yourself personally. And so the risk profile of a typical medical doctor is just very high. You either have or are presumed to have a high net worth, and depending on your area of practice, you are going to have high legal liability as well. You have extensive government compliance regulations from HIPAA and even wage and hour and employment claims, you know, and employment laws. If you have your own practice, you're an employer with employees, and now you have employment lawsuits and employment law issues that you're going to have to deal with. Your investments will have liability and also generate money, like from real estate that you're going to be investing in, and you can be serving on foundations and boards. And so what we do is just provide peace of mind for clients and lifestyle preservation, and really more importantly, just how collectible you are. And now within our network, we're protecting collectively over it's now over $5 billion worth of assets now. And a large portion of our client profile are medical professionals who also are investing in other risky assets like real estate.
Well, well, I'm scared now. So there you go. But no, I think it's really important to discuss, because like we talked a little bit about before the show, I think people just don't think they need it, right? So you get out of training, your income quadruples, quintuples overnight, right? You've got probably a sizable negative net worth when you come out of training because of student debt. So people are like, well, you know, I got nothing to come after. What are they going to come after? That's not true, right?
Correct. And so what you need to do is start thinking about where you are. Like first, you know, like do some financial planning, pay off your debt. You know, don't go buy a Porsche or something. I see people do the opposite. Oh, I got this big paycheck. I don't go buy like a BMW or, you know, I have one neighbor who bought a couple, and then I'm like, well, how's your school debt coming along? He's like, yeah, I need to get to that. I'm like, maybe you should have got to that before you bought those BMWs there, but because the sooner you get out of debt, the more money you have to invest. But as you start investing and growing, if you think about it like a red button, your button and your visibility keeps growing, 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 and expanding. And so that's great that you have this ability to generate wealth and generational wealth potentially down the road if you do it right. But your liability and visibility grow with you. And you can just be a new resident, you know, just out there and not generating much money. But just because you wear a white coat, you're now presumed to be one of the haves. And this affects you even if you're just driving your car and you get in a car accident. Oh, yeah, he's a doctor. Now I'm suing you.
Fair enough. So what, you know, what's the first layer of protection, right? You know, we talk about layers of protection, and what's step one? If we're, you know, let's say someone's not hiring a great guy like yourself to do it all for them. And I know a lot of docs try to do it yourself, even though I tell them not to. But what's step one for someone with a high negative net worth just out of training? What do they do first?
Great question. I'd like, first listen to what you said. Don't do it yourself. You're a doctor. you do what you're trained to do and what you're good at. You know, don't try to DIY it and think that you're a lawyer. You're not, you know, and you're not a CPA. So don't think just because you're really smart, let the other smart people in their specialty do what we're really good at. Just like I'm sure I get it all the time. My doctor friends are like, well, you're not a doctor. Like, stop, you know, being a Google doctor. Don't be a Google lawyer. You know, that's where bad things happen. So step one, you know, talk to the experts, and then just understand, let's say, what is asset protection before we get in even to like the first layer. You know, like, yeah. what are you even trying to do? Like, what is this fancy word? And asset protection is not traditional estate planning. It's modern estate planning. And what we're doing is just placing a legal barrier between your assets and a potential creditor, like the person suing you, before it's needed. And that's the key word, before it's needed. That's it. It's just a barrier, like a safe for your gold or your guns or other valuables. anything of value you want to put behind the legal barrier and out of your personal name so that it's not easily attached with the lien or reached, you know, just like the rich. And I love the Tony Robbins saying, you know, like success leaves clues. The rich don't own things in their personal names. Their businesses own them. Their estate plans do. Their asset protection trusts do. They just get the beneficial use and enjoyment out of them while separating out liability. And so that's the first thing that you want to understand. Like, that's the concept of what you're doing. And then there's different roadmaps or stops along the way that you would go into it. And like you mentioned, the first one, the very foundational one, you're just starting out, is an LLC and insurance. And so those are the very basic beginning entry level spots, but then those will have some weaknesses with them as well.
Okay. So I think, you know, I think LLC, I think is fairly understandable to the general doc. But, you know, a lot of people say, well, I'm an employed physician. You know, why do I need an LLC? So how does that work for someone who's a W-2 employee, you know, let's say with a hospital system?
Yeah. So what you want to do is, let's say that you're a W-2 employee in the hospital system. They're covering you for malpractice. You're making, you know, a decent income now. And now you're like, okay, I want to go get an investment property. That's where the basic level LLC comes into play. You put risky assets, like anything that can requires insurance, that has a key, that has a motor, that can go boom, that can hurt somebody, you want out of your personal name and into an LLC. And I think everybody understands like what an LLC is, limited liability company, but they don't understand first word, first letter, limited. And they're easily pierced depending on the state that you're in. And so everyone hears about the positive side of LLCs, but they don't understand the limitations of them. And so LLCs is the first layer, asset protection 101. It's entry level base layer that most people are, like I said, are going to be familiar with. But what they don't understand now is that the courts now have a tendency to disregard single member LLCs. And then you have CPAs that tend to set up the LLCs, or you, when you create them on your own, which is why I don't recommend that happening, to set up the LLCs as disregarded entities for tax purposes. That's great for taxes, but bad for lawsuits. And what being disregarded means is that the IRS is not taxing your business. You know, they're taxing your business separate from you. It passes through to you personally. And because of this, they're basically worthless for asset protection or lawsuits wise, because that liability now, just like the money, passes directly through to you. But like, don't get me wrong, like, I like them. I use them. I use them at the very foundational entry level, LLCs combined with insurance. But what you want actually as you level up in wealth and liability is for that single member LLC that's holding your real estate to then be owned not by you, the individual, but by a second layer of protection, which would be like a limited partnership, but not another LLC and not by you. And what you're doing now is layering and growing and then having the K-1s from those LLCs flow directly through to that management company. So it's just one easy tax filing at the end of the year.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, my understanding was that LLCs offer you zero protection for malpractice lawsuits. Is that true?
It'll offer you some from the business stand of it, but from your malpractice, you know, like you would have your business entity, like if you own your real estate and your property, put the real estate into an LLC and separate, like, you know, from slip and falls or, you know, employment issues and stuff like that. Then you're going to have your own malpractice insurance on the side from there. But people need to understand malpractice insurance just provides, you know, the capital to fight a lawsuit. And generally, that's going to be drained just to fight the litigation portion of it. So there's going to be not much money if it's a big lawsuit to actually pay damages. And so that's where having a good asset protection structure to protect your actual assets, like your home, your investments, that's where an asset protection plan really comes in for that next layer level of protection. So it's not so much the LLC at that standpoint, but it would be an asset protection trust. And you'd want that trust if you're a very successful doctor, a lot of our clients are OBGYNs and surgeons. They would generally, we would recommend what would be called a bridge trust, which is an offshore trust domesticated, which I can break down later on. That's where the true protection for them come in, because it's at that point a matter of just how collectible are you.
Okay. So what about we're still sticking with the employed W-2 physician, works for the hospital, doesn't own any real estate, just, you know, goes to work, cashes his check. What he or she do for asset protection? Because they don't really have anything to put into an LLC at this point, right?
Yeah, they're worthless right now at that point. So like, you know, it's sorry to say, you know, like I would just say right now, like Dave Ramsey yourself, focus on crushing your school debt and then start investing. Because like right now your employer is, you know, indemnifying you. You have malpractice insurance, hopefully for like up to $1 million. In that aspect, you don't own anything that needs to be protected. So there's nothing really to collect on you on to where if I'm suing you, I'm coming after your equity, which is money in the bank account. And I'm coming after, you know, the equity in your home or your assets. And if you have nothing to protect, then you have nothing to, you have liability, but nothing to collect on. So there's nothing we can really do at that standpoint beyond foundation insurance. And hopefully you have indemnification with your employer. It's when you start adding and accumulating more assets. Your 401ks are exempt from lawsuits through federal exemptions. Your IRAs, you know, kind of are as well. So those are protected assets. So what we're looking at is protecting unexempted assets that you have from collectability.
Okay, that makes sense. Now shifting gears to the 1099 employee, right? So it's a lot of docs right now are getting paid as contractors. Probably their malpractice is getting covered, but I know a lot of them are confused as to whether or not they should be getting paid under their name. They should set up a S corporation or an LLC. Is there different asset protection concerns when it comes to being a 1099 rather than an employed physician?
Yeah, so then you're going to be liable for your errors, you know, even if they're negligent or not. And then if you own the building that you're operating out of, like we were talking about in the beginning, all that extra liability is on you. And if you have staff, you own equipment, those are assets. So that's where you need to start thinking about structuring with how do you own the building that you have? Is it in your own personal name or is it in an LLC? You know, generally you want everything out of your personal name. You don't want to have assets, you know, meaning real estate and land and anything in your own name. It should go into an LLC. Generally talk to your CPA and decide how you want to be taxed. Do you want to be taxed as an S corp? Do you not? That classification would have different legal ramifications for lawsuits in the sense that if you own real estate, you would not want to be putting your real estate into an LLC and then elect to be taxed as an S corp because, or even into an S corp in general, because S corps have shares. It's not like a limited liability company. They actually are like a corporation where they have shares which can be seized and frozen by a judge. So real estate rule of thumb goes into LLCs. If you're just doing a business operation and operating separately, you know, obviously you're going to want to probably elect to be an S corp just for the tax, you know, passive tax flow benefits right there. So it's a matter of just carving out what assets you have, separating them out from you, putting those into separate LLCs. Then your business operation itself would be a separate designed entity that you would create. And so it's how we would structure the whole system from there to one, protect what you have from lawsuits and separate it out from the other liability.
Okay, fair enough. So we talked about layer one being an LLC, and then starting to talk about layer two. What's layer two then? How do we move up from there?
Yeah, layer two then would be a family limited partnership or like an FM. We call them AMLPs, asset management limited partnerships, just because when you use limited partnerships for asset protection, that's just what they're called, asset management limited partnerships. They're like LLCs, and they also have some charging order protection. And then we like them better than LLCs at that next layer because you have a very distinct delineation between the managing partner called the general partner and the minority partner who does not. And so think of it like a split personality. We like having both the GP interest and the LP interest, which are separate. And we use the limited partnership as the starting point for clients as a management company or a holding company. And then we just add an asset protection trust to it for the actual asset protection component later on as a third layer. It really is the combination of the two that work together that you want to capitalize on. But some of the very specific reasons we prefer using, and specifically an Arizona limited partnership on this versus like a Wyoming LLC or Delaware and others, are that you have exclusive charging order protection in Arizona as the only remedy for creditors of a partnership. And so it exclusively has to be a partnership. And then you have an actual statutory distinction between general partners and limited partners, and that's by statute. And so this is better than an LLC, because LLCs can only do this through an operating agreement that then the judge in the court would be left to interpret themselves. And you don't want a judge waking up on the bad side of the day who's just making the decision of saying, yeah, your operating agreement sucks. I don't like your tie today. And sorry. And you want to be able to control as much as you can. And so we have ARS section 29-333, which is very specific to Arizona. And this is really where a lot of the magic comes from. It allows a unilateral withdrawal from the limited partnership on what we call a predefined event of duress. Like, we would name a lawsuit as a state of duress. And once that state of duress happens, we can then disconnect the limited partnership from the whole, from the holding company and the asset protection trust. And you can do this by statute. If you try to do this with just an LLC, you would be exposing yourself to fraudulent transfers. And so that's another reason why we like limited partnerships. Those are just like really a few of the really top ones. And then another of the good ones of why we like limited partnerships is the perpetual. Whereas every other state, you're going to have annual reports and filings for your LLCs and renewals every year. Arizona doesn't require listing the limited partners. So like if you're listed as a limited partner, Arizona is not going to require you to be listed as that. So you have some natural anonymity and privacy completely built in by statute already. And then tax filing purposes, how I mentioned the disregarded entity portion and how that's bad for LLCs. Limited partnerships cannot be disregarded entities, but LLCs with just one member are automatically considered a disregarded entity. And that's not good for liability issues and lawsuits, like I mentioned. So what you want are all your foundational layer LLCs owned by that limited partnership. And then eventually that limited partnership will be owned by your asset protection trust.
Wow, that is really interesting and pretty cool, actually, on the Arizona side. I didn't know anything about that. So that's neat. This is totally off topic, but it popped into my head. But I hear a lot of, some gurus out there saying that, when you buy your personal residence, you should put it in a family member's name or a wife's name or something like that. I don't buy into that advice personally, but yes. Like, what do you think about that?
No,
I know that's like a common thing you hear out there.
Well, then there's like tenancy by the entities and stuff like that. And the issue is then when your spouse gets sued, it's all tied up. It's an issue. It's easier and cleaner and simpler to just have a really strong asset protection system and a very strong trust, and then put the trust directly into that, the asset directly into that trust. And so like I'll break down the trust next. And if you're using a very strong like bridge trust, which would be one of the strongest trusts in the world, you just put your home, your personal residence directly into that is protected. And from some of the, some of the strongest case law in the world protecting it. Don't put your personal residence. I don't recommend putting them into an LLC, because if you do that, then you lose that, $250,000 tax credit if you were to sell it. And then you have to transfer it back into your personal name for like 3 consecutive years out of 5. And so it just really makes it difficult. So the best way to protect your residence, just put it into an asset protection trust. But a revocable living trust, like I mentioned before, is not an asset protection trust. That's just going to dictate who your beneficiaries are and your medical directives, your financial directives, and what's going to happen when you pass. Your assets should be owned in that three-tier system that we have, all owned by the asset protection trust. Your revocable living trust would just be referenced in that trust as, per our, surviving spouse's death, assets are to be distributed per 123 State Street revocable living trust.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. Well, for those, for those that don't know, could you just explain what a trust is? Cause I don't think we said that. And I'm sure there's plenty of people listening who don't even know what a trust is.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where like the third layer of your protection, like your outer shell weather, like it's really cold, it's snowing, you're stuck in Siberia. This is where you know, you want to be when you end up getting around like 1 million net of unprotected assets, you really need to think about very strong asset protection trust. And trusts have been the longest lasting entities of all entities. And they go back even to the Roman times for holding assets. You know, like they would go and fight a war. They would put their assets, you know, for someone else to watch over them and then name beneficiaries. If they were to die at war, the assets would then just, you know, pass off to their beneficiaries. But when done right, they're very strong and can be sculpted to fit how you need them. And they can morph as you need them without dealing with even funding issues that you see with LLCs and other business entities. And so I just love trust. And having a trust at that very top third layer position of your planning is just very powerful. And that's where creating an asset protection trust and more importantly, picking the proper jurisdiction comes into play. And trusts have lots of different flavors and types, like we were talking about. The standard 101 trust that, you know, most of your listeners are familiar with came about from like the 1960s is the family revocable living trust. So, you know, trusts don't die. So when you do and you actually funded them, which most people forget to do, they have like their lawyer create their family estate plan and then they forget to transfer the assets into the trust. So once you transfer ownership and title into that trust, you don't have to go through the probate of courts. It just changed the landscaping of estate planning. And then you have land trust for real estate that you hold your land, and then you connect them to LLCs at very base layer entry position of asset protection. But the issue with that is that land trusts don't have any protection in and of themselves. They're just for like privacy reasons. They're only as strong as the LLC that's connected to them. From there, you have higher levels of trust that are called asset protection trust. And these are really came about in the 1980s, and they started in the Cook Islands. And what these are, they're called self-settled spendthrift trust, meaning that they're created by you for yourself as your own beneficiary with some creditor protection and spendthrift provisions built into them. This lets you protect your assets while you're actually living from creditors and people suing you and not having to relinquish control of your assets. The difference is they allow you to protect the assets, not just for your grandkids, you know, but for yourself, which you weren't allowed to do in the past. Now, the difference with asset protection trust really comes down to where do you set them up in, you know, and why it's so important is that the laws and the rules that govern you and trust and business entities are different from one jurisdiction to another. And this means from one country to another, one state to another, and even county to county. And so you really have three options when you're creating asset protection trust. You can establish them domestically in the US, or you can set them up offshore in another country like the famous Cook Islands, or you can create a hybrid, which is kind of the best of both worlds, combining the both of them. And so if you want, like I can break down the three differences for them if you want.
Yeah, sure, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I'll do it through like a historical understanding, because I think if you understand the history of it, you understand the content, the context of it, and then it's easier to comprehend. So for the historical context of it, the offshore trust actually came first in 1984 when the famous, like I said, Cook Islands created an asset protection trust. I personally prefer the power of going offshore if and when it's needed, because it's just the strongest and best home court advantage. And the power of the foreign offshore trust is that it has what's called statutory non-recognition. That's why it's globally the gold standard, even after 40 years of existence. What this means is that your US judgment would be worthless in the Cook Islands. You'd have to start the case all over from scratch, facing the highest legal standard in the world, which is the murder standard. So they have to prove a case beyond the reasonable doubt. The plaintiff, the person suing you, has to front all the court costs and fly in a judge from New Zealand. You can't take your U.S. attorneys with you there. You can't have contingency fee-based attorneys. If you lose, you pay, which is a whole nother legal hurdle, which we don't have that legal hurdle here in the U.S. And there's only a one-year statute of limitations to get a lawsuit even filed there. So lots of statutory hurdles, but like everything, there's always a negative to something, right? If you're purely foreign, not everybody needs that level of protection. For most, it's just way overkill. And honestly, a purely foreign asset protection trust is just a hard pill for people to swallow. They're generally very expensive, generally about $50,000 to start, and then generally $5,000 to $10,000 a year to maintain. And so then because of the cost, what you see are most people don't want to deal with that cost and all the IRS hurdles that you have to do by annual disclosures of assets in those trusts. So they start putting them into domestic asset protection trust here in the US, like the Nevada Asset Protection Trust. The domestic US-based asset protection trust came into play 10 years later after the Cook Islands, and it started in Alaska. They brought the creators of it from the Cook Islands here to the US. And then, not to be outdone, now we have, you know, Wyoming, Delaware, Nevada. They all followed suit, and we have about 20 states now in the US that have some sort of domestic asset protection statutes and legislation. But the problem with purely domestic asset protection trusts and why they fail is on effectiveness. And that's just because of the US Constitution and the full faith and credit clause. You can't run from judgments. And so if you're being sued from one state and you live in another one, you still have to recognize the judgments from other states, full faith and credit. And then we have a really important case in California, Kilker versus Steelman 2012, that came out and said, hey, you're a California resident. We don't care that you went to Nevada and created a Nevada Asset Protection Trust. Guess what? You're not a Nevada resident, so you don't get the benefit of that trust. So we're not going to recognize it. And they pierced the trust. And we're starting to see this across the nation now. And so the courts are starting to pierce purely domestic asset protection trust. And so because of the case law that we're seeing, I'm not a big fan of anything purely domestic that's an asset protection trust, or anything purely domestic at all, without having some sort of offshore built-in component with it. And that's where the hybrid system version comes into play, which is called the bridge trust. And that came into play just about 25 years ago. And so about 95% of all of our clients are using bridge trust. Like I said, it's a really strong hybrid. And what you're doing is just combining the best of both worlds. You're combining the 40 years worth of statutory case law that you get, like even up to the US Supreme Court, of the Cook Islands strength. So it's a fully registered offshore Cook Islands asset protection trust from day one, from the moment you create it, with an offshore trustee in standby just in case you need them. But then we build the bridge back so that the IRS actually classifies the trust as a domestic US trust by just complying with USC Section 7701. And so because of that bridge, it's cheaper, it's more flexible, you have none of all the annoying IRS compliance and really no IRS tax filings and disclosures at all, because the trust is actually classified as a domestic US grantor's trust. But you get the power of offshore if and when you need it, because if you ever do have that doomsday scenario, we immediately drop compliance with USC Section 7701, and now the trust is purely foreign.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. That's my head's spinning now with all this, but that's this is all the more reason to the listeners to hire somebody like Brian to handle this stuff for you, right?
And so, like, I know, I'll sum it up really quick. Like, how it all works and comes together is like this. You know, like, the first layer is your base layer. Your insurance, your single member disregarded LLC, and these LLCs will hold, you know, your real estate, your other assets that can hurt somebody or has a key or can go boom like boats and planes. The next layer is your multi-member asset management limited partnership, which acts as your holding company, and it holds the bulk of your assets, like your LLCs, as well as cash, stocks, bonds, passive syndication shares, receivables, whatever. The final layer is your outer layer, which is the asset protection bridge trust, and it's going to be the minority limited partner of your limited partnership, not you. This is the non-controlling interest, but it's the ownership interest of that limited partnership. And that's what separates out ownership from use and enjoyment. And then you either die and your assets get distributed per your living trust, or there's a crisis, like a big lawsuit. The bridge trust is triggered and the assets cross the bridge through that migration policy and dropping that, you know, compliance with USC section. And then the power of the statutory non-recognition comes into play. And then having all that in your back pocket is where the effectiveness of the trust comes into play, because now you're sitting there as uncollectible.
Right. So that, you know, I think that's a really good summation. And, you know, for the listeners here, what everything Brian's talking about is getting to the point where you get to keep all your stuff, right? I mean, you get to keep your assets as opposed to having it being collectible under in a huge disaster lawsuit situation.
Correct. Because even if you lose, let's say you lose a $5 million you know, lawsuit, you want to be able to sit there and have your offshore trustee say, well, great, we don't recognize it. And then you're not going to be able to be held in civil contempt by, you know, the U.S. Grant case, U.S. versus Slow case. You know, all these are, you know, the great thing about offshore trust is you have 40 years of very solid, very strong case law all the way up to the Supreme Court with some people doing really bad things. You're talking about the Andersons who are a Ponzi scheme, the, you know, like the Grant case and Slow cases of people taking $36 million and stuffing them into foreign offshore trusts. And I don't condone any of this activity. I'm just using a very extreme examples of very famous cases where bad people doing really bad things and the government, the man who can print money, who has infinite amount of resources, couldn't even pierce the Cook Islands Trust. And you have 40 years of these cases. And so that's what you want to understand is the strength of this. You just don't need to pay all on the upfront portion of it. That's why you domesticate it. So you have it in your back pocket if and when you need it.
Perfect. Yeah. Guts you rest easy. That's for sure.
Yeah. And then it just forces, it allows you to force a settlement for pennies on the dollar or to just completely, most of the time when we have to trigger these, once the opposing party realizes like, wow, they actually have that foreign trust and they are completely uncollectible. Even if we win, we can't collect and we can't force a collection. They just walk away.
Makes sense. Wow, great. Well, we're running out of time here, Brian, but I just wanted to shift the show a little bit. Other than saving, you know, protecting your clients and learning all this awesome stuff about how to keep our money in our pockets, what do you like to do for fun?
Yeah, I'm very active. I love traveling. I just learned how to lift foil board, which is awesome. It's sort of like a combination of paddleboarding, snowboarding, and surfing with a little joystick in your hand, and so you're just cruising around on the water, carving, with no boat pulling you. So that was really cool. A lot of mountaineering. I just like enjoying my life, hanging out with my two daughters. You know, taking them to dance classes, gymnastics, soccer.
That's great. That's awesome. What, I got to look into that. That's, that sounds pretty fun. what is it called again?
It's a lift foil board.
Lift
and
foil.
So, yeah. I was up, back where I'm from in Lake Tahoe, and the inventor of it happened to be hanging out at the beach right next to me, and he had three of them out, and his friends were going on, and we started chatting and got along really well. And he was like, hey, man, let me give you like a quick little lesson on how to use it. He's like, take it out for like an hour. And I was like, wow. Oh, really? And he's like, yeah, no problem whatsoever. Like, go out on it. And it was, for an adrenaline junkie like me, it was perfect because paddleboarding is fun, but sometimes it's just like you're just floating. I like to be able to, go fast, sometimes, get a little bit of my adrenaline pumping, and it worked out perfect.
Huh, that's neat. Do you have any book recommendations for the listeners? It could be on any topic.
Yeah, a great book, I think, for your listeners if they want to start investing. Rich Dad, Poor Dad's always a great starting point for that. I like the Cash Flow Quadrant better because it breaks down his principles that he talks about even more into that. The Richest Man of Babylon. You want a personal growth development book, which I'm really into personal growth. The Alchemist is always a great story, for a personal journey.
Yeah, I've read all four of those, and they, I agree, are all kind of vital, I think, to life and wealth. So that's awesome. If you've given us like a lot of advice thus far, but if you could distill down one single piece of advice to the listeners for the early career physician, what would that be?
Surround yourself with success. I'll give you, and a second one, don't be piggish. Like I learned that one starting out on my own is sometimes you might have to take less to get more. And then if you're surrounding yourself with success, think of like King Arthur, probably not you shouldn't be the smartest one around your round table. You should be the last one to speak, to hear what everybody has to say. And all the people at your table should be smarter than you. And then that way you can always make the best decisions and always learning. And then if you end up being the smartest man at the table, either change tables or change the people sitting at your table.
Yeah, I love that. That's what they say. Your net worth is the average of their five closest people around you, right?
Absolutely. And just realize you might end up outgrowing some and don't feel bad about having to reposition them in your life.
Perfect. Well, Brian, thanks again so much. If people wanted to find you or interested in the asset protection services you offer, where can they find you?
Yeah, they can jump on my website, www.btblegal.com. I use it more as an educational resource for people with a lot of frequently asked questions, videos, educational videos, and a lot of case law, because I'd rather just people say, okay, here's an actual case. Let's read this. And I don't really see many other firms talking through case law. And me being a trial lawyer, that's where, you know, like I look at the bread and butter of, if I'm in court, how's this going to most likely play out? So I put all that up there for people to read. And then they can just email me, Brian, B-R-I-A-N at btblegal.com. I do a 1 hour free consultation because I'd rather just have someone have education and understand and have some good references to make educated decisions. And I find people are too afraid to shop around and talk to lawyers because they don't want to pay consultation fees. And then they end up getting no advice or Google advice.
Fair enough. Or that's great. I'll put everything in the show notes for the listeners. Thank you again. Thanks for educating me and everyone listening. And best of luck.
No, thank you. And thanks for having me on.
All right. Before we go, let's give another shout out to our sponsor, CareCloud. Don't let bad billing processes keep you from your hard-earned revenue. CareCloud's free revenue cycle assessment uncovers billing mistakes so you can see how to claim every last dollar. Get your free assessment by visiting drpodcastnetwork.com/CareCloud. Again, that's drpodcastnetwork.com/CareCloud. Don't wait. CareCloud is ready to help your practice thrive. What a fantastic show with Brian Bradley. I really learned a lot for my own life and will be able to apply some of the strategies he talked about. Certainly, the last thing you want to think about is asset protection, but in a career like ours, you got to protect yourselves. That's all we have for today, so thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please go leave me an honest rating and review on Apple Podcasts, as it really helps get the show out there. The other thing I'd like you to do after listening is visit my website at andrewtissardio.com, where there are a free 4-part video series discussing my path from burnout to career satisfaction, as well as other helpful links. Find me on all social media and reach out with any questions. Until next time, everybody, keep talking. All opinions expressed by the guest in this episode are solely the guest's opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Andrew Tisser DO, TalkToMe.LLC, or any affiliates thereof. The guest's opinions are based upon information he or she considers reliable, but Andrew Tisser DO, TalkToMe.LLC, nor any affiliates thereof warrant its completeness or accuracy. The guest, Andrew Tisser DO, TalkToMe.LLC, or any affiliates thereof are not under any obligation to update or correct any information provided in this episode. The guest statements and opinions are subject to change without notice.